This week on Crime World.
There was a Republican police from 1920. I mean, the IRA was effectively trying to run an underground government. And actually, there was a crime wave. 1919, 1920, there's a wave of bank robberies, post office robberies, robberies of individuals, robberies of pubs in Dublin and in rural areas as well. So the IRA tried to actually clamp down on that. They, on occasion, solving bank robberies and giving the money back to the banks. Now,
I'm Nicola Tallant, and you can listen to my podcast, Crime World, wherever you get your podcasts.
On this week's Big Tech Show, when will cars safely drive themselves on our streets? And who in Ireland is providing the technology to help them do that? We talk to one of the country's biggest automotive autonomy entrepreneurs.
I have BMW drive assist in my own vehicle, and it is much, much safer because we are all prone to distraction, especially when we're on the motorway from Limerick to Dublin, for example. We've all been there where you actually forgot a whole section of the road. So I would say if you take it from a safety perspective, and it does allow you to kind of relax.
The Big Tech Show, available on all podcast platforms.
This is an Irish Independent podcast.
Well, I suppose anytime you get a goal, it's perfect timing, you know. But no, definitely. And, you know, they took them well when they came as well. Those transitional moments, they're hard got now in the game. And you have to work really hard for them. But, you know, I was delighted, like, even in the second half when we got, you know, turnovers or close to our own goal and stuff, that the sort of the passion and the drive was there to get up the field and support each other. So, those bits and pieces were very pleasing.
Hello and welcome to the Throw-In Football Show. I'm Colm Keyes, standing in for Will Slattery again. And we're looking forward to discussing all the weekend's action on the show. With me is Dick Clerken and Frank Roach. And I'm going to go to you, Dick, straight away, because Ulster is really very much where it was all at again this weekend. We had two remarkable games in different ways, but probably best to start in Celtic Park on Saturday night. And maybe two words, Jim McGuinness, what he's done with Donegal in such a short space of time, manifested there very much.
Yeah, he's delivered again, Colm. There's no question about it. And I'd say Mickey Hart must be sort of scratching his head, not just the manner of the defeat. It was, there's no question, tactically it was one on the sidelines. Obviously has to be played out on the pitch, but when you see a group of players on both sides, you know, not functioning or functioning at the level that Donegal was, that comes from the days and the weeks building up to it in terms of the preparation. And there is no question that Jim McGuinness again, you know, trumped Mickey Hart hands down. So, you know, early in the season, albeit a massive statement from Donegal. And, you know, we were talking here last week thinking, you know, reading, let's be honest, too much into Donegal's not just league form, but the type of football that they played in the league, because what we've seen in Celtic Park resembled, you know, little or nothing than what we've seen in the league and the league final that we probably had based a lot of our assumptions on. And, you know, like you've seen in Jim McGuinness's time as first time as Donegal manager, the league was always just a preparation for the championship. And we've seen that again on Saturday night to root this effect.
Is it fair, Dick, to describe it as an ambush? I mean, Donegal played to a very high standard in the league. It was expected that they would really put it up to Derry. And when you say tactically, Jim McGuinness got the better of Mickey Hart, where was that most in evidence?
Well, I think if you remember back to our conversation last week, how did we see the game being played out from a tactics point of view? What was Donegal going to bring? We felt that based on how they'd played in the league and how I'd seen them, that Donegal were trying to play a more forward pressing type of play, you know, really challenge the kick out, but even if they didn't win the kick out, try to tackle and turn over teams high up the field. And we've seen that in evidence throughout the league. It was the ninth minute before Donegal got their first kick out. They actually started quite poorly. Donegal or Derry started well. It was the ninth minute before they got the kick out. And if you look at that, yeah, they put a bit of pressure to get on it. But the minute they lost that kick out, and if you didn't notice at the time, watch it back, it was almost like how the Donegal players done it back in 2011, 2012. They just turned on their heel and they ran straight back down to the field in defensive formation. So that there was, when I seen that, I says, right, that is that is the battle lines drawn as a sort of, this is how we're going to play tonight. And that was the instruction that had been drilled into the Donegal players, probably not over the last week or two. I'd say this is what they've been working on, because that's not how Jim McGuinness has worked. You don't just rock up with a set of tactics. They were well drilled, and it was almost back to what he knew best and what got them that All-Ireland. And that caught Derry. Derry just weren't able to get into any flow of momentum, no space to run into. Shane McGuigan was sort of completely suffocated inside. And that was the departure from what we've seen in the league. That really sort of, and then breaking fast. You know, it was one well and good defending tightly. They were able to break fast, but it was giving them that sort of real strong foundation to build off, really set them off for the evening.
Well, Frank, to you, obviously, the main talking point coming out of all of this was the role of Oran Lynch and the fly keeper, the sweeper keeper, going up to contest kickouts, huge gaps, Derry pushing everybody up to contest the Donegal kickout, and Donegal being able to counter that with bodies over the top and to get into space. And really, we saw three goals emerge from that particular pattern. What was your read of it? How much did Derry get sucked into this, and how much did it influence the game?
It had a huge, huge impact. I mean, you know, for this to happen once in a big championship match is a talking point. You know, for it to happen twice would have been wow. But three times, and like, all you have to do is look at the scoreline. Goals won that match quite clearly. And, you know, it's not the first time that Oran Lynch has been caught out. I mean, it famously happened against Galway a couple of years ago when he was well up the pitch and Damien Comer got that goal. It happened in the first round of the league this year down in Kerry, and Derry won, and probably it was maybe glossed over. Now, that wasn't from a kick-out issue, but all three goals here came from Lynch basically coming up, marking a player, marking space, whatever. And it's clear as day that Donegal had looked at this, had mapped it. Donegal have a huge advantage over most counties in that Sean Patton has a range of his kickouts that very few, if any, keepers can match. And he's also he always strikes me as a keeper who can adjust very quickly. Do you know, he sees, I'm going to go to the opposite wing to where Lynch is, which they did for the first goal. And it took Lynch completely out of the play. But he's able to kind of think on his feet and adjust on his feet, which not every keeper can. I mean, there's several intercounty keepers. They're telegraphing nearly where they're putting the ball. But so McGuinness had the ammunition to maybe take him on. The other issue to consider is that Lynch strikes me as not the most mobile of keepers. Others will be able to react more quickly and try to get back in position. For the first goal in the first half, he was very slow. He was almost realised a bit like Paddy Cullen too late in the day back in 1987, the 78 final, that, oh my God, the house is on fire. What am I going to do here? But like, you know, 4 or 5 seconds had passed before he realised that. And the damage was done. The second goal, I think he probably could have got it. You know, another keeper, like Lynch, almost got back into position to deal with it, and then he got his feet in a mess and a muddle.
He just slapped it away, Frank. He actually got his hand to it.
So he still should have stopped that, you know.
Is there negligence there on behalf of the Derry defence that they didn't get back to cover, Dick? I mean, the cover was not there. At one stage, Chrissy McCaig stayed with Oisin Gallen, I think, for the first goal. Didn't come out to meet him, didn't get back on the line, stayed with his opponent. So was there negligence that the coordination between the defenders for this wasn't there?
I think two things.
Go ahead, Frank.
Yeah, well, two things is, A, it's not all on the goalkeeper, because this is a team strategy. It's not even a tactic. It's part of what Derry have gone with. And they've been doing it for a couple of years, but they've maybe in a way doubled down on it this year. So, you know, when it happened once, definitely then when it happened the second time, hold on now, this game is getting away from us. Do we have to adjust here? So that's coming from, you know, it's partly on management. But I also think it was indicative of how Derry were on the night, that, you know, too often they were very slow on breaks. the reactions weren't what we have seen for not just the league, but for most of the last two and a bit seasons, like, you know. So, you know, I think it's unfair to lay it all on the goalkeepers at his door. I just think Derry were they were nearly passive. They were waiting for someone else to take responsibility too often on Saturday night.
With obviously Lynch getting drawn in so much, there's obviously some emphasis on where was Conor Glass, where was Brendan Rodgers in contesting some of those kickouts. That's obviously an issue that the Derry midfield did not really get any foothold last Saturday night either.
They didn't. And I'd give any team a pass with, say, the first goal. You know, it caught them. But it was so obvious what Donegal done in that instance that Mickey Hart, Gavin Devlin, these boys are about long enough to say, oh, seen that before. If that's not the first time Donegal or Jim McGuinness' team have done that to that effect. And it's a case of, well, that they should have seen that, well, they're going to try that again in this game. They're not going to try it with every kick out. And they didn't. Like, they got three kick outs out of whatever it was, 20. But it should have, because of the risk reward around it, they should have been guarded against it. Like, if you look back at that first goal, it actually ended up a 6v2 attack. Those six Donegal players were ahead. So far ahead, there's only two Derry players. That didn't happen by chance. That was planned by Donegal, that when that ball goes over the top, and I was saying to a few ones last night, the only thing those Donegal players have to think of, I am just running forward fast. And if that ball breaks to us, I'm going to be ahead of the man behind me and he ain't going to catch me. And that's exactly what happened. And then they just did the play. So to that effect, Derry should have been guarded to sort of say, well, this is what they need. For that tactic to work, they have to allow us, or they have to pull us all out of position, and we have to empty out the division. And that's what they've done again in the second half. So they can't get any, you can't get the benefit of that in that second half, because they've done it on two other occasions. So somebody either on the sideline or on the pitch needed to sort of say, right, guys, we need to mind the house here, because this is coming again. And they didn't. So that's where they have to take, you know, somebody either on the pitch or on the sideline has to take responsibility and say, we got that wrong. We didn't see the risk, and we didn't mitigate against it and it cost them the game.
I remember seeing Oran Lynch joining and to go up and contest another kick out after the fourth goal had gone in, and I felt it was like the band continuing to play while the Titanic sank. It just felt like that they persisted with it throughout. Frank, put it to you. Is the risks associated with this far greater than the rewards? Because obviously there's a distinction between going up to contest a kickout or fill space in a kickout and leaving those gaps behind and joining the play when your team has possession. There is a distinction here.
Well, I think that's probably the biggest thing. And most of the damage that we've seen in matches where goals have been scored with the goalkeeper, we'll say, gone AWOL, the majority of them are probably coming from kickouts. And teams are targeting this now. Now, the counter argument is that we probably in the last 5 or 6 minutes in Killarney on Saturday, Cork, Kerry were, I think, protecting the 2-point lead, and they weren't fully pushing up. They were pushing so far, but not far enough. And Shane Ryan was there regularly in that prolonged spell of keep ball, as he was the out ball. You know, he was the Kerry's plus one in that scenario. And, you know, in that case, it worked. It worked for Kerry. But I think part of it is you have to consider the goalkeepers you have. I mean, Shane Ryan is an outfield player. He's very, you know, he's very calm and composed on the ball. Niall Morgan is an outfield player, and he's a brilliant footballer and a brilliant athlete. So I think some keepers are better suited to this role than others. We actually had an incident, I think maybe halfway through the first half in Hyde Park yesterday, where Colin Reap of Mayo advanced towards the Roscommon 45 and he was turned over in the tackle. And suddenly, like, you could see, like, the, you know, the alarm bells were ringing, and Reap was making a mad gallop to try to get back. And for a couple of seconds, it looked like Roscommon were going to be able to engineer a potential goal chance for Ben O'Carroll. But Mayo got sufficient backs back into position. And I think the play ended with Reid getting his hands on the ball in the end. But, you know, it was high wire stuff. And there have been so many goals scored this way during the league, even before Saturday night, that I think some managers have to start coldly assessing whether it really is worth the risk.
Well, let's hope they don't, Frank, because it creates such great excitement and talking points that long may it continue, because it is the one time in a game, not the one time, that's wrong to say, but it's one of the times that really engages the crowds and engages everybody when there's a turnover and a chase back up the pitch. So, as I said, long may it continue. Dick, does it wound Derry's overall prospects? I believe it actually edges them a little bit closer to it. I think this is the better path for Derry, because Ulster 3 in a row are hard to achieve. If you look back at history, the Armagh team 04-06, down 1959-61, in the post-Cavan dominance era, say into the mid-50s, it's only happened twice. It's a really difficult thing to do.
And especially now with the workload that is on players in a condensed period of time, like there is a tipping point in terms of how long any player or group of players can stay at the top in terms of optimal performance. And maybe that's what we've seen with Derry. Like they operated at such a level. And even look at maybe the cumulative effect of Glenn's run, you know, at some stage that's going to rear its head. And maybe that was what we've seen on Saturday night, just mentally and physically, that they just weren't at the level that they have. Now, as you said, they've a great opportunity. They've what, 3 or 4 weeks to get back, bit of rest, bit of recovery, and whatever the physical and mental recovery, they learn a huge amount, possibly for meeting Donegal again. There's nothing to say that they won't see them in a group stage or in a knockout, so they learn from that. They'll also learn from just maybe their own preparation. I'm sure they'll probably reflect back and sort of say, well, because generally, and from my experience, when you don't perform, when you're not either physically or mentally right, you generally look back in the weeks leading up and say, nah, something wasn't right. There's either a complacency or different stuff was going on, and they have an opportunity to learn from that. So, you know, Mickey Hart, they will be bitterly disappointed, because, you know, even though, yes, maybe in the long game, it's not a bad thing, but in the short term, you know, they were Ulster champions. They relinquished their crown to you know, Donegal at home. You know, Mickey Hart will not enjoy losing again to Mickey to Jim McGuinness. So it potentially could be, because the only guarantee we have in the short term, it's a tough defeat for them. It'll only be of benefit if they actually do go on and use it, Colm, in terms of winning All Ireland, because that's all that's left for them now. That's all that's left for them now this year is when, if they don't win an All Ireland, that defeat on Saturday night will be seen as a negative. If they do and learn from it, it's a good. But again, that's the bar now that they have to meet. Anything short of that, it's not progress on the years before. So there's a lot now at stake for Derry to bounce back from that tough defeat on Saturday night.
Just before I move on, Dick, your column this morning on the Irish Independent website is flying through the numbers. And obviously there's a reference to Jim McGuinness and his historic issue with Declan Bogue over a book that you yourself were part of from the Monaghan side back in 2011, reflecting on the Ulster Championship in 2011, and obviously in 2012, because of the collaboration, at least we thought because of the collaboration between Declan and Kevin Cassidy, that Jim McGuinness refused to engage in the post-match press conference after the All-Ireland final with Declan Bogue, who's now with the 42, previously with the Belfast Telegraph. And at the Ulster Championship launch last month, Declan Bogue has said he was on off the ball last week, where he said that he was excluded from the round table interview at the instruction of Jim McGuinness. Now, you've obviously referenced that this morning, and just to reflect on your take on that for a minute.
Yeah, and I think it needed to be called out. Maybe it'd be nice to hear and be interesting to maybe get your own thoughts from people, you know, within the industry as to how that should be dealt with. I was very disappointed to hear that rearing his head again. I know Declan obviously was involved. I in that book, that's now a notorious book, and a very disappointing to see. You know, I think from a professional level, from Declan, like nobody, like that's his job, that's his livelihood, no more so than any of his. You know, no manager has the right, I don't think, to compromise that. And it's something that I just felt personally that I should make reference to. I separate it from, and hopefully the column reflects that for the genius and the excellent work Jim has done with Donegal. But I think with this, there's a standard that we should all aspire to in terms of how we navigate our games. And I'd be very disappointed seeing that happening. And I don't think it's something that should be tolerated. It should be called out. And that it was no more than that. And I don't think it needs any more than that. And it's up for anybody else, Jim, people within the journalistic space to deal with. But I just felt it deserved comment, and that's all I can say about it.
I think from our point of view, we'd certainly look at it differently than in the moment in 2012. And I feel it'd be, I think it's very important for Jim McGuinness to come out and say specifically. Now, he's had opportunity, obviously, did an interview with Paul Kimmage back in 2016, where he referred to inaccuracies. Is it the fundamental issue of collaboration with a journalist? I mean, Declan Bogue was doing his job, and he did it superbly for that book, and it was a fantastic book. So I think it'd be very helpful now, and I think it's very important to state exactly why he has been left out once again here, because it's inconsistent. And Declan has said he has been in groups where Jim McGuinness has conducted interviews in his presence, and there is no consistency to this. So I would think at this stage Jim McGuinness should come out and specify what is the reason behind this.
I think so, for Jim's benefit. Like, the headline is probably a bit unfortunate. Maybe that's why it's doing the rounds this morning. But it's more a case, I think, personally, I think he's letting himself down, because he's so fantastic in other ways. He brings so much back to the championship now, not just in terms of his personality and the colour, but also in terms of tactical nous. And I think it's just needless. I think it's needless at this stage. Enough time has passed. At the end of the day, for my person, Declan Bogue never done anything wrong. It was his job. He writes books. He's a journalist. That's what he's done. If Jim had issues with who participated from a Donegal point of view, deal with that, but not somebody who was just simply doing his job. And that was my perspective on it.
The obligation going back to 2011 wasn't on Declan Bogue to inform Jim McGuinness of Donegal that he was putting this book together in the way that he put it. He collaborated with nine players from all the Ulster counties and threaded the journey to it. And it's a great historical record. We talk about access and insight and all of that. Well, that provided it, no doubt, in 2011 on that particular championship. We'll move on to Tyrone and Cavan, and a statistic from full time yesterday in Kingspan Breffni Park. Cavan 314, Tyrone 120. That was 1 point more than the 75 or so minutes in Cusick Park where Clare and Limerick played out their first round of the Munster Championship. So an Ulster quarter final outscored in 70 something minutes than first round Munster game between the two Titans. And in Cusick Park, it's a fast pitch, it's a scoring ground, and yet this happens. What does that say?
How do you follow that intro?
Yeah. Football's obviously in crisis. I mean, Jesus, they're letting in scores left, right, and centre. There must be something wrong there. It was actually, I think in the round, it was a pretty good weekend for the Gaelic Football Championship. And the irony is that it's happened just as the big throw-in has started for, you know, the hurling round robin. And this is the part of time of year when everyone gets really energized and excited about hurling because of especially the do or die nature spread over 4 or 5 weeks, admittedly, of the Munster Hurling Championship. But, you know, the drama in Celtic Park on Saturday was incredible. I mean, I watched all that match on TV. I only got to see the highlights so far of Tyrone Cavan because I was in Roscommon yesterday. But, you know, it was one of these matches where it was gone from Cavan. And then maybe a black card happened, a kind of disputed black card for Pádraig Hamsey, and 10 minutes later, Cavan are back level, you know. And even watching again the highlights in extra time, it looked like to me that players were literally out on their feet. But we had levels of heroism from probably no one more so than Matty Donnelly, like back after a horrific run of injury. I think it's 8 months or something like that. And he's at a stage in his inter-county life where you must be partly tempted to sort of just throw your hat and say, look, I've had a great run. I've won my All-Ireland medal. why go back to the well again? And yet there he was wearing number six. I'm not too sure if he played the entire game at centre back, but Matty is some example of a player who will do everything for his county and in nearly any position too. So, I mean, I think it's very hard. It's hard on Cavan, what they've already contributed to the championship, like, you know, beating Monaghan, coming back from the brink yesterday, and yet they're there thinking, oh, that's it, like, you know. But it's not it. They've still got the All-Ireland series to look forward to.
Yeah, they've put two very, very good championship performances back-to-back now, so they can look forward. But, Dick, it's an opportunity lost to bridge that gap back to 1983, and these things matter in Ulster, very, very much so.
It is, as well, if you look back, and I think Enda McGinley made reference last night, like, on the team sheet, that was a very beatable Tyrone team by comparison to anything that they've had out over the last, God, what, 20-odd years, and you had them at home. And I'd say they look back on that first half with huge regret that they didn't really have a proper cut at that, knowing how vulnerable Tyrone actually were when they went at them properly. They maybe that history, maybe the scars of having a few sort of heavy defeats over Tyrone over the last few years, maybe, you know, give them an aura greater than they actually merited. And it was only when they had a proper cut at them they realised, geez, these boys are very beatable. But the gap was too big. And I say the energy ultimately that Cavan had to put into getting that back sort of paid the price. Like, I'm actually here in Cavan with a client, would you believe it, the Cavan County chairman this morning. So we've had a good debrief of the match, and, you know, they were sort of saying, like, you could visibly see the Cavan players were just out on their feet come extra time. They physically weren't able to run, and the you know, they were cramping up, and that was just probably the tipping of the head. But, you know, been sort of, you know, maybe thinking more long term about it, like, they'll take a huge amount of confidence going into the All-Ireland series. I think probably to have to go and beat a Donegal and possibly an Armagh, an Ulster title, was always probably going to be a stretch. So it's definitely progress. They're trending in the right direction. They'll all be looking forward to a great, you know, now he's back in Breffni and the supporters came out for them. So they'll take a lot of heart out of it. It was an opportunity missed, no question about it. But I think they're young enough, and there is a, you know, unfortunately, as a Monaghan man, there is a squad and something building in Cavan that can sustain itself, which hasn't been the case over the last sort of 10-15 years, you know.
And once again, Frank, Tyrone very much looking to Dara Canavan to guide them, to lead them, in even through their troubled times in that game yesterday, he inevitably came up with something. 15 points from their full forward line, 7 from Dara, 3 frees, Darren McCurry, 4, 2 frees, Rory Canavan. They look like a really, really strong line now that's only going to get better.
Yeah, and like, and this is coming after an absolutely brilliant league from Dara Canavan. And you've got to factor in that it was in a Tyrone team whose form was very up and down through much of that league. You know, they had good days and then the next day, just as quickly, a bad day. But I can remember the first round of the league, they were home to Roscommon way back in late January. Miserable enough day. Tyrone are reduced to 14 men early in the second half. And in the next 10 or 15 minutes, Dara Canavan just grabbed that game by the scruff of the neck. I think he scored 8 points, 5 from play in total. And he carried that on in several different rounds of the league. I mean, he is everything about him, like his movement, his audacity. I mean, it's like watching the dad, really, like, you know. And he is very much one of the key, the pillars of this. It's an evolving Tyrone team. It's hard to believe, like, it's 3 years since they won the All-Ireland. And I think Enda McGinley reference figure, was it 16?
16 of the panel, yeah.
16 of the panel weren't around for that All-Ireland win. Like, so it's an incredible level of upheaval for a team who weren't probably seen as an old or a seasoned team back in 2021. You know, they were almost a team that came from up the blind side. They definitely did come on the blind side to win that All-Ireland. But ever since, and it started the following close season, early 2022, there was player after player were dropping off that panel. I think they lost 6 or 7 in that first year. And they've really struggled to get their act you know, to get it together as a contender ever since. Now, their form yesterday, is that enough to suggest they're still going to be in the mix? Hard to know. Like, it's probably not. But it'll be really fascinating to see how they shape up against Donegal now next weekend, because it's hard to believe. I mean, this is the new compressed season. We're just absorbing what happened over the past weekend. And these players are already in serious prep mode for next weekend. It's coming that quick and fast.
Is that game fixed venue-wise? I haven't heard. Maybe you've heard, Colin, the throw.
No, I haven't heard yet.
Clonus, possibly? I'm just thinking, because, you know, psychologically, these games, you know, has a huge bearing, no more so than the Saturday night game, in terms of the frame of mind of both teams coming in. I would argue, psychologically, Tyrone have the advantage now in that semi-final, in terms of they're the underdog. They can look and sort of see and prep for Donegal's key strengths. Like, Donegal, player for player, I don't think there's an All-Ireland in Donegal. I don't think they've got the calibre of players individually to get up to Croke Park. You strip out those goals, which in some ways they're a bit of a, I have to be careful here with my words, a statistical anomaly. Like, you throw that ball out in the middle of the field, some days it breaks for you, another day it breaks the other jersey. And that's happened a lot of those times. It went for them on three occasions. Another day you throw them out, they don't drop to you. Because remember, they only scored 11 points. They weren't prolific outside of those goals, so they can't rely on that, especially if Brian Duher and Logan, they sort of say, right guys, whatever about anything, these guys aren't getting two or three handy goals. If they want to knock 17, 18 points on us, good luck to them, but we're not handing them, you know, a sort of a 9-point head start. So the big thing for Tyrone now is recovery, you know, because that day yesterday, I have to imagine it was energy sapping. Not only was it a warm day, extra time, but that it would have been still a very tacky, heavy pitch in Breffni Park. You could see it. You could actually see Brian Duher on the footage after. He was basically getting those players in, didn't want them out on the pitch another minute longer in terms of doing interviews or autographs, get them in, get the recovery going, because they have a big job of work now to get the energy back into the legs and have themselves prepped. So I think that psychologically, it's all in Tyrone's favour, because they're the underdogs, but they've seen what they have to try and prepare for. Whereas Donegal now are elevated as to, you know, a potentially All-Ireland winning team, which I don't think they are.
Frank, I put it to you about Dara Canavan's influence on Mayo, on Tyrone, sorry. Does Ryan O'Donoghue carry that same influence with regard to Mayo? You were in Hyde Park yesterday and delivered once again. I thought it was notable last week after the New York game. Kevin McStay said, he's the best corner forward I've seen in my time, and I've been around a bit, said Kevin, to the Western people after the game in New York. He certainly delivered again.
He delivered again, big time. I mean, not too often a player has scored 120 after two rounds of the championship. Now, there is the obvious caveat that 113 came against New York, but O'Donoghue has been delivering for Mayo pretty consistently now, I would say, for four. He's actually gone into his fifth championship season. And is he in the very elite of these corner forwards? Like, is he a David Clifford? No, he's not. He's a different type of player. He's not. There's no one. How many players are at Clifford's level, or even maybe Con O'Callaghan's level? But he's a versatile footballer. He's so clever. His movement yesterday, off the ball movement, was brilliant. Classic low center of gravity. Is able to take a ball on the turn. He literally, there was one score there where he took the ball and was turning in the same movement for it. So, and also, he's a brilliant passer. He's a lovely foot passer. So, you know, he has it all. The issue for Mayo up to now has been that they're bloody too reliant on Ryan O'Donoghue. And this has been very, very apparent for much of this season so far. And the good thing from a Mayo perspective yesterday is that it wasn't all on him, that another four forwards chipped in with at least two scores from play each.
Ryan contributed another 7 points, Frank, but there were other Mayo players that chipped in as well. Fergal Bowl and Tommy Conroy came strong in the second half as well. And we've been waiting for him maybe to catch fire a little bit and use that pace of his. Was that evident as well?
Well, we saw hints of it in the second half. It wasn't vintage Tommy Conroy, if we call it that, but there's a very relevant stat here. I mean, Mayo won the match yesterday through a purple period from the 40th to the 57th minute. I think they outscored Roscommon 8-2. Tommy Conroy started that run with the first point, and he bookended it then with the final point of that run. But in doing so, he scored more than Conroy had managed in the entirety of the National League. He started 5 games and came off the bench twice for Mayo during the league, and in that time, he only got 1 point from play against Derry. And like, you know, we all know how explosive a talent he can be. We haven't seen enough of that since he came back from his unfortunate cruciate injury in early 2022. He was back. He's been back basically as part of the Mayo setup since the start of last season. But, you know, we've only seen little flickers of what he can contribute. And if Mayo are to progress deep into this championship, and by that I mean getting to, you know, at least an All-Ireland quarter-final, they can't be just relying too heavily on Ryan O'Donoghue. Because every team is going to have a plan for Ryan in that basis. Conroy is a totally different type of player. But when the two of them are operating well in tandem, they offer something very, very different, and it makes them harder to stop. The other key thing yesterday, I thought it was probably the best I've seen Aidan O'Shea play probably this year. He had a very good league last year, didn't have a great league from what I could see this year. But it wasn't just that he got the goal, and it's the first goal we've seen for a number of years in Championship anyway from him, or that he got a point in the second half, but he was involved in a lot of Mayo scores. And it was telling that when he came off around the hour mark, there was a huge cheer from the Mayo fan base there. And that's a Mayo fan base that Kevin McStay referenced afterwards that were maybe a little bit subdued on the day.
That's a point I was going to put to you, Dick. Kevin McStay did reference that, and he was encouraging the Mayo crowd, who always get out for games, regardless of when they are or where they are. But Kevin McStay was encouraging them to get to the Connacht final in a couple of weeks' time. Never a great sign when a manager has to do that. Obviously, there's a lot of games and ticket prices, and we can go into that. But Mayo always turn out. Numbers were probably down on where we would have expected them. Is that a sign of something?
There might be, like, if you think of what Mayo supporters have gone through over the last, 10, 15 years, it was always predicated that we can win in All-Ireland. We're up there. We're not far away. And I just wonder, has that sort of hope, you know, fizzled out from them? Have they sort of seen, oh, we're just too far back here. We've too much ground to make and haven't seen enough over the last couple of years to suggest that it's there. And maybe that's just feeding in, because they sort of had a bit of an indifferent league campaign, obviously still very sore after the way they went out last year. And maybe that carried into the Hyde, which I'm sure there was a lot of belief and sort of on Roscommon's side. But whilst it wasn't the sort of a swashbuckling Mayo performance, I think those types of sort of ground out boring wins wouldn't be the worst thing for them, because that's what they never really had, you know, back in that time. Just try to be clinical, do enough, you know, don't have to be, you know, that this sort of gung-ho type approach, a wee bit more measured and structured, and getting a spread of scores from around that's the sort of makeup of any winning team, no more so than Dublin over the years. You know, they weren't reliant on massive high energy. It was a case of, you know what, just more than enough players playing at a 7 or an 8 out of 10 will get the job done. And it doesn't have to be, you know, high octane stuff all the time. So, you know, maybe the Mayo supporters will see that and sort of say, listen, we've a team there that there is potential. Like, they're maybe the sum of the parts, as opposed to any sort of, you know, like Aidan O'Shea is an example. I think I said it in a few podcasts this year, they need to figure out, you know, what's his role, you know, and maybe, you know, just the way the game has developed, you know, he's not going to have the legs for the way the game has gone out the field. but unquestionably he can be an asset in on the square. You know, even looking at that goal, like you referenced it there, Frank, when was the last time we seen him in Championship football take a ball like that and just barrel through players and blast it into the net? Like, he's well fit to do that. He'd done it back in the day, but he just sort of stopped doing it, or they didn't place him there and commit to him. So, you know, especially with the forward mark, the way that, you know, teams, defenders aren't used to defending, you know, forwards going at them like that, that could be a serious asset for them. So it'll be interesting to see if they persist with that. Because I think that if he's going to have a role, that's where it's going to be, and try to have all those other players there that have the legs, the likes of O'Donoghue, Tommy Conroy, do their thing out around the edges, but him be a focal point on the square possibly.
I have to say, I always prefer a chaotic Mayo rather than a structured Mayo. I just never feel that they do structure or a team that sets up like that against them. When it's a little bit more chaotic, I think they always try. From Russ Common's point of view, Frank, this is another second half fade out, which has been very reflective of their league campaign. They're certainly not where they were this time last year.
Definitely not. In reference to those second half fade outs, I did a little bit of homework there this morning. I said I'm going to track their first and second half performances right through the league and into Hyde Park yesterday. And it's not that they've been brilliant in the first halves of many matches this year and then fell apart. But if you add up the cumulative scores in those eight matches, at half time they were 3 points down. And they lost the eight second halves by a combined 25 points. So that tells you something. Now, I got the feeling going into the Hyde yesterday that, just talking to one or two locals as well, that there was no great sense of optimism that the team were going to be able to turn their poor league form around and do an ambush, you know, complete an ambush on Mayo as they did last year. And I mean, that's really how it played out. They did very well to battle back to be only a point down at half time when, you know, having kind of they were hit hard early by Mayo. Mayo were 4 points up. But what followed for a lot of it then would seem to me was a combination of Mayo almost kind of going back into their shell and Roscommon relying on the first half brilliance of Dermot Murtagh. He had 4 points at half time, three of those from play, and he was scoring off either foot. I mean, he's very much a kittog, but he kicked two from play off his right as well. But then the second half, it's like everything kind of started to unravel a little bit for Roscommon. Their shooting efficiency, which hadn't been brilliant in the first half, went way down. I mean, they had five wides, three short, hit the post with another effort. Dermot Murtagh suddenly, instead of scoring with everything, was missing with nearly everything. And I just think there's quite a few guys on that team that have been around for a long, long time. This is probably especially so in the forward line. And I just think they look like a team who are on the, you know, they're kind of in the gradual decline nearly. And
but does Darragh Craig and Ben O'Carroll, do they not add energy to those? My suspicion is that Roscommon are not servicing. They're not playing a game that is more suitable to those players.
Yeah, I think to pick up on Frank's point, I think when I look at Roscommon, having watched them and Pearce, they always feel very one-paced. It collectively, you know, and that's a lot to do with, you know, how they're set up to play, like by comparison, just taking Donegal that we've talked about, you know that instruction that it's when you go fast. Do you know what I mean? Don't even think about it. You run with intent. You tackle with intent. I watch Roscommon. I don't see that. I see passiveness. I see it's very lateral. And that sort of permeates right through the team. Whether you're a 32 or 33-year-old, you know, warhorse like the Dailies or boys like that, or the young lads, that sort of seeps into a overall collective. So when I see Roscommon, I see that type of play, and that when you need energy in the second half, as you're saying, Frank, that it, you know, you can't just sort of, you know, drop up a gear or two because you've been playing at that sort. So it'll keep you really competitive, which we've seen in Roscommon. But when, you know, the wheat is separated from the chaff, very often you're left behind because Championship football And especially at the top level, it demands pace. And it's not just running from A to B. It's how a team collectively and mentally, you know, responds to breaking ball, or, you know, when the opportunity to break with numbers is there. I think Roscommon just have developed a style of play that lacks that. And that evidence was in the Hyde yesterday.
And I think it's probably evident, in fairness, in that kind of level of pessimism I referenced, you know, among Roscommon people, that there was no great groundswell that, you know, of hope that they were going to do a number on Mayo yesterday. Now, I think in Ben O'Carroll's case, he's just back from injury. I mean, he was a late addition to the team, feeling as he probably was always going to start. But I mean, he basically had a marathon club campaign with Bridget's. I think he got injured on Sigerson duty, played very little league football and was only just back. And he definitely was not at his best. And he's the one guy who offers not just pace, but trickery, elusiveness, that bit of daring do that Roscommon probably don't have enough of. Derek Craig was good, in fairness. He was good in the second half when too many players around him were not offering very much. But they just look like, I totally get your point about that they're not maximising maybe what they have up front. But I think one or two of these players, they have been around a long time too, and how much more they have to deliver is open to question.
We're talking about Darragh Canavan and his influence, Ryan O'Donoghue and his influence. Do we look at Damien Comer in light of his rescue act for Galway on Saturday against Sligo? Do we look at Damien Comer in the same light for Galway, Dick?
Well, they needed an impact. You know, I didn't get to see the game or pick it up. I was tracking it on my phone, and it was like they were beating Docket the whole way through until they got a bit of impact. They got a bit of energy, and it came in the form of Damien Comer. Like, it's been well documented how Galway have been, you know, a pale, you know, version of themselves, of the team that competed in All-Ireland with the likes of Comer, Kyle McDade and others not on the playing field. So on one hand, you'd imagine Pádraig Doyle is sort of scratching his head going, like, boys, if we're not beaten, and no disrespect to Sligo, if we're not beaten Sligo comfortably, you know, we're not in the All-Ireland conversation. But the fact that they beat them, albeit, you know, the last minute goal, but more importantly, they've got one of their key assets in Damien Comer back. That makes them a much different proposition. Potentially, it's all about potential. That's all you have going into the next game. So he'll have confidence now that they got out of jail. They've got one of their, you know, their five-star men back up front, which you've seen, albeit in a cameo performance, that he still has that impact, that physicality and that scoring prowess, because they've been missing that. They need that. And sometimes a single player, it's not just what they can contribute individually in terms of scores, it's the confidence they give to the boys around them. It's how they can actually pull other boys into the game. And Damien Comer, and there's not too many players around that can do that, but Comer, as we've seen, you know, can do that. He can be a focal point of attack. He can bring other players. He can take maybe two or three defenders to try and shackle him, which brings other Galway attackers into the mix. So, you know, if they can get him back fit for 70 minutes, you know, Galway's trend, albeit tentatively, is starting to move in a better direction than what it was for the best part of the last year.
Frank, they lived dangerously on Saturday, but obviously Sligo, there are many green shoots appearing there too. They've been Connacht Under-20 champions the last 2 years. They're right in line perhaps to retain it over the next couple of weeks as well. So they're really pulling things together. And this was evidence of that they are heading very much in the right direction.
Very much. I mean, like, it's what we're probably seeing now are signs of their success at under 20 level is starting to seep into the senior setup. But also, they look like a team who have got better with each passing year under Tony McEntee. You know, that there is a clear level of improvement there. I suppose what they have now is, like, I mean, last year they went into the All-Ireland group stages, and I was at their first match at home to Kildare, and they got a great draw there, like, for them, which was a super result, and it kept them potentially in the chase for, you know, for a knockout place up until the last round, when I suppose they ran into the Dublin juggernaut. But I suppose, like, they're heading into a different environment now, but it's a competition they can definitely look to they can definitely look to target.
Just in relation to Kerry, obviously got the job done against Cork. Probably a similar game to last year in Parkyqueeve in the round robin. Last year Sean O'Shea was very good too against Cork. This time he was very much their leading light to get them over the line. It was probably inevitable when they got level, Dick, that they would go on to win it. But it took them a while to get there.
Yeah, I wouldn't be too hard on Kerry in this one. Like, we talked about it last week that there was all the signs that Cork were going to arrive in Killarney to play. And, you know, they finished the league very strongly, you know, winning three and drawing one of the last four games. There was a bit of confidence coming out of them and they brought that. And it was great to see it because, you know, we bemoan too often Cork not turning up and being a championship team. So, you know, there wasn't that massive gap between Cork and Kerry going into the game, and that's the way the game played out. They kept it competitive, and, you know, sometimes a sort of a hard-earned dirty win is not the worst thing to do against a decent opposition, and that's what Kerry got done. You know, they don't need to be firing all cylinders. There's plenty of years that they would have done Cork for double digits in Munster, and it paid them no benefit later on. So, you know, they'll come out of that, no injuries, hopefully, from a Kerry point of view, but they'll probably comfortably win the Munster final against Clare, but it's not like they're going to be getting ahead of themselves. They know they've got work to do. It'll keep the Clifford sharp, and that they're not, you know, too comfortable in their own skin. So I don't think it's necessarily a bad thing, because I expected Cork to be competitive, and now there's no guarantee knowing the way Cork has been, and that's what they were, and they got a good game, because, you know, too often in the Munster Championship Kerry have walked through and have served no purpose. So it'll not be the worst thing for them to get out of there with a hard earned win.
Frank, do you see enough in their midfield for them to sustain a really strong challenge in the months ahead for an All-Ireland title? It's Dermot O'Connor and Joe O'Connor, two very fine footballers, but against Glass and Fenton and Brendan Rodgers and these players, Ian Maguire and Colin McCallan are obviously a very formidable midfield pairing. But is it an issue, an ongoing issue for Kerry?
Well, I would say they probably struggled in the first quarter on Saturday. You know, they were definitely losing the midfield battle at that stage. But it seemed to me that Kerry got more bodies in around the kick-out from that point onwards. It wasn't necessarily the biggest issue Kerry had on Saturday. I just thought that for the first 10 or 15 minutes, there were open channels right through the centre of their defence. And maybe that was partly coming from midfield, but, you know, several of the chances, it wasn't just kind of that they were losing kickouts or whatever. There was turnovers there. And Cork, as Cork do, ran hard at them. It wasn't kick passes into space that were necessarily causing the damage. But, like, Cork could have had a goal before Paul Walsh scored, even. Like, they should have had two goals in the first 4 minutes, could have had maybe three goals in the first quarter. And this, it seemed to me like here was an occasion where the loss of Jason Foley was palpable, not just for taking him out of the equation, but actually pushing Tadhg Morley into a different role, into a kind of man-marking role of Brian Hurley, who was on fire, like, on Saturday, and removing him from that kind of role where he's been sweeping to such good effect for Kerry. So there were definitely defensive issues there for Kerry to work on. And in a way, they were kind of, you could have predicted them to an extent beforehand.
That's an issue for strength and depth for Kerry. That's, to me, is apparent that they the numbers are not coming through at sufficient quality to compensate for issues like Jason Foley's injury. That is something about Kerry right now. They don't have the depth in Dublin.
They don't. And I mentioned a couple of times in the podcast earlier in the year that I would have, you know, concerns about their midfield, but that's what they have. They don't have too many other options to come in there, and they have to work with the two guys to get the best. So it's going to be a weakness. They're not going to improve dramatically enough to be on a par with the best midfield that are out there. So they'll have to figure a way to accommodate that and coach the guys into, you know, the role as midfielders in the modern game. Like, you still have to play box to box. You have to be a link player. You have to have defensive duties. So they'll have to try and work on that to try and make sure that weakness isn't exposed, which we've seen it. No more so than going back to that Dublin, you know, game earlier in the league, because it is probably an area that they will be targeted, you know, as they get further into the championship.
And it's Kerry and Clare, of course, in the Munster final, and venue to be decided because the Gaelic grounds where that game would normally be played is apparently out of action. I'd like to see Kerry concede advantage and put the game on in Cusick Park. Clare were looking for that. They were looking for a home and away arrangement. They were looking for a home and away arrangement for last year's final. It went into the Gaelic grounds. It can get a bit lost. Cusick Park, 20,000 attendance. It would be absolutely perfect for it. Now we'll wait and see. Maybe they'll toss for home. Maybe they'll toss for home venue. But at the time that we're recording this, that's not just decided just yet. We're going to leave it just there now, lads. Thank you very, very much. My thanks to Dick and Frank for joining me. And don't forget to rate, review, and follow us on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcast from. Thanks for listening.